And we're back. This is Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. I'm in the studios here of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha. Beautiful day in downtown Waukesha, coming to you from this wonderful location. I'm here with Connor, who is my producer, and we're also taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789 with our review this morning of some of the major stories of the past week in law, government, and the aspiration for justice in America. In our first hour, we spent a lot of time chatting about a couple more Supreme Court cases, actually four in particular, not just a couple, that are going to be decided fairly soon here by the United States Supreme Court. We had chatted in previous weeks about the guns case. We talked about the abortion case. And this morning, we also chatted about these other four cases that the Supreme Court's also going to issue in the area of environment, in the area of immigration and religion. So it's difficult to imagine a heavier docket coming up here. And right before the break in our first hour, I began to tell you a little bit more about the Supreme Court's schedule. They tell you in advance when it is that they're going to be issuing opinions. They don't tell you exactly which cases they're going to be deciding, but we know with a fair amount of certainty when those cases are going to come out. And so the Supreme Court last week indicated that Monday was a decision day and Wednesday was a decision day. And sure enough, they issued a number of different cases, a number of different rulings on those 2 days. The cases we discussed this morning and previously in those five different areas were not among those. We're not among those. And so we're getting fairly late in this term in June of 2022. There is a lot of precedent for the United States Supreme Court issuing decisions, including as late as last year, well into July. And there really is no rule that prohibits them from issuing opinions later on in the term. We are still in the 2021-2022 term. This term will not expire until the first Monday in October of this year. It will be called the 2022-2023 term. But more immediately, before that happens, long before the fall, we are going to have a number of weeks, days here when, in the headlines, on a regular basis, major Supreme Court cases in these five various areas. And we know that the Supreme Court has already told us that this coming week and the week after will be decision days among its calendars. On Tuesday, June 21, that's this coming Tuesday, the first day of summer, they're going to be issuing some additional opinions, so take a look at that. Be careful in watching the news there to understand clearly what they're doing and what they're not doing. They may, in fact, issue some opinions in these areas, may wait for some other days. We also know that on Thursday, June 28th, two very important things are going to be happening at the Supreme Court. One is they're going to be issuing more decisions on June 28th, so getting fairly late in the month of June, and again, could very easily go into July as well. In addition to the decisions, the rulings that they announce for all of us on that particular day, they're also going to be having a decision conference, a half-day decision conference on June 28th, which suggests again that there will be future decision days, opinion issuance days coming up down the road. So undeniably, we're going to be focusing a lot in America on these high ticket, these high visibility issues in the weeks just ahead, including the coming Tuesday. So take a look at your calendars. Note that those are going to be important days in the jurisprudence of our Supreme Court and also the lives and livelihoods of all of us. You know, so from time to time, people ask, well, gee, how does the Supreme Court make decisions in all these areas? Why is it that the legislature is not issuing its own legislative packages on these areas? And frankly, at least two, if not more, of these cases raise those issues with particularity. And when you think about the immigration issues and the environmental issues, among the others, but certainly those two, that the United States Constitution almost certainly contemplates that our Congress, our Senate, our House of Representatives would be the basic institution. That branch of government would be the one that establishes policy in these areas. And one of the arguments that's made inside the environmental case, inside the immigration case, is that because the Congress has not acted in years and years and years in a major way in these two very important areas, that therefore the executive branch has to do so. And so, again, in our first hour, we talked about President Trump's executive orders and the rescissions of those, the reversals of those by President Biden and President Obama's executive orders in various areas, all attempts by the executive branch to engage and to make rules for America in situations where the Congress itself has not acted. And the Supreme Court undeniably is going to be addressing that kind of issue, telling us whether those actions by our executive branch can go forward and whether these particular actions are legitimate under the Administrative Procedures Act, or whether the Congress under the Constitution is really the only institution that should be deciding these matters as a policy matter, as your elected representatives. Are they the folks, not the courts, are they the folks who should be deciding all of these cases? So these are big constitutional issues. We have talked before about where this issue comes from, where the notion, the doctrine of judicial review comes from. It goes way back to 1803. Chief Justice John Marshall, again, a lion, an icon in our jurisprudence at the Supreme Court level, in a case called Marbury versus Madison, a fight between a couple of our very first chief executives, Jefferson and Adams, about an appointment. And during the course of that opinion, Chief Justice John Marshall said to all of us, words that are still used, invoked by the Supreme Court to this day, the Supreme Court said, it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department, meaning the courts, to say what the law is. Let me repeat that. It's emphatically the province and the duty of the judicial department to say what the law is. That was a concept that at the time of the passage of the Constitution, even at the time of the writing of the Federalist Papers, wasn't entirely clear, this notion that the courts themselves will decide on the constitutionality and tell us what the law is, not only if the legislature does not act, but also in times when it does act. So we know there are many instances where the United States Supreme Court will take a look at actions by the legislature and determine whether those are constitutional or not. So a lot of big ticket, very heady academic issues going on and being implicated again right now this week in these areas of very, very great importance. We've got guns case coming up. We've got the abortion case coming up, privacy rights along the way, immigration. We've got matter involving religion and, of course, also the environment. All of those big ticket items going to be decided by the Supreme Court, at least in part, in the days just ahead. One decision day coming up Tuesday, June 21, just a few days from now. Another one later in the month, and almost certainly yet another date into the month of July, perhaps right before, right after the 4th of July itself. There's another big event that I've hinted at in the course of our conversation this morning, also coming up in the life and the history of the Supreme Court, and that is its new term. It begins its term every year on the first Monday of October. That will happen again in October of this year, the 2022-2023 term. And why is this particular term significant? We know well that Justice Breyer, Stephen Breyer, who is still making decisions, who is still issuing opinions and concurrences, writing majority opinions, writing minority dissents, he is still on the bench. Even though he has announced his retirement, we know well that he will in fact be retiring after the conclusion of this term. That term will conclude whenever the Supreme Court is done. It's got about 16 more cases altogether to decide. Whenever they've taken care of all their business on their docket, when all that is done, Associate Justice Breyer will formally retire. He will resign from the United States Supreme Court. And who will take his place? We know who that well. That's Associate Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. Right now, she is a judge in the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. You recall well that President Biden nominated her in anticipation of Justice Breyer's decision to resign from the Supreme Court. And way back on April 7th of this year, by about a 53-47, Judge Jackson was confirmed to be the next justice of the Supreme Court. She will formally take her oath of office upon Justice Breyer's retirement, his resignation, his final departure from the United States Supreme Court after a long and very distinguished career, and she will become the next member of the Supreme Court. and she will begin to hear cases in October of this year. So that is big history in the life of the United States Supreme Court as we go forward with all of that. We're just taking your calls on all those kinds of issues, the important issues before the Supreme Court in the coming days. 844-967-2789. This is WAUK Radio, 540 AM, 101 FM. As we go forward this morning, again, entertaining your calls, your comments about all this, we'd also like to pursue our discussion of what happened this past week and this past weeks at the January 6th committee. Lots of focus in the past several weeks on these public hearings, revealing in many ways the kinds of things that the committee has identified to this point in its month-long inquiry. A lot of that done in camera, outside of the presence of cameras and outside of the public viewing. That has changed, as you well know, in the past couple of weeks. After interviewing about 1,000 witnesses, assembling quite literally a trove of well over 140,000 documents, the House Committee on January 6, investigating the attack on January 6 of 2021, is finally unveiling some of its findings in public. Promised by Benny Thompson, who is the chair of that bipartisan committee, promised that this will not be all of the information, but indicated that there will be a written report also coming out, presumably in September, presumably before the midterm election, summarizing all that they have found, but revealing now in these public venues, these televised venues, the things that they have found to this time. There have been three highly anticipated and much watched televised hearings, sort of a curated primetime session that began this, describing in general terms the arc of things that the committee is going to be presenting, its overall conclusions about what it has found. And then we've had two sort of sprawling daytime sessions just this past week in which they've been digging more deeply into the findings, the things that they have discovered, and the implications of those for American democracy. And so in the remaining time this morning, moving beyond the Supreme Court cases, not that they're irrelevant at all to the January 6th hearings, we're going to shift our focus to January 6th and talk a little bit more about the things that have happened, especially in the televised hearing of just this past Thursday. Very significant events, circumstances, lots of testimony out there showing videos that, again, are going to implicate not only this report coming up, but also our understanding of what happened on January 6th of 2021. Join us for more of that discussion right after the break. This is WAUK Radio, Waukesha, 540 AM, 101 FM, taking your calls at 844-967-2789. This is Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. I'm in the studio here of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha. My producer, once again, is Connor. We're taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789, inviting comments, questions, observations, and other perspectives on the important issues we're discussing this morning. Spent most of our time up to now talking about Supreme Court cases, anticipating major headlines in the coming days in a number of different areas, including environment and religion, certainly abortion, guns, and immigration. So we'll look forward to seeing those opinions and certainly talking about those in future shows. And that's going to be coming up in the next few weeks or so. Right before the break, we began to have this discussion about some perspectives, some summaries, if you will, some views on what this January 6th committee, led by Benny Thompson, and certainly a bipartisan group of members of Congress, reviewing what happened before, during, and after the insurrection, the riot on the Capitol on January 6th. We know that there have now been three public hearings on these matters, on these topics, and they joined a first hearing that happened way back in the fall of last year. Remember the police officers, the Capitol Police, who came forward to set the first stages for the presentations that we're now seeing? Those officers describing the events of those days from their perspective, the physical, the emotional suffering that they endured as they tried to protect the Capitol from the onslaught, the rioters who were coming in, hugely compelling testimony back then, and I would offer hugely compelling testimony in the bookend that we're now seeing months later after the committee has done further investigation, further pursuit of what happened on January 6th, both before and after that event. And I would offer to you that what we've seen up to this point, especially this past week, especially on Thursday of this past week, committee really putting together a downright remarkable series of events beginning in December of 2020, right after the election. And it was about that time, as the account goes forward and the testimony and the other evidence being presented by this committee shows, it's when the president at that time, President Trump, and his allies, people around him, Rudy Giuliani, a fellow named John Eastman, again, much in the news these days, a private attorney, among other things, John Eastman came up with this memorandum, much now heralded, we've got a copy of it, that outlined a mechanism for restoring, if you will, what he believed, or maybe didn't believe, but nonetheless purported to say was the steal and the way of overcoming that by keeping Donald Trump in office. All of that began to happen in December of 2020 when Donald Trump, our former president, and those allies really had exhausted all of their legal avenues, the things that were available to them. Remember, all of the federal courts had taken a look at this, challenging the results in various states around the country, including right here in Wisconsin, about 60 of those cases, 60 of those judges coming forward and saying, you know what, there's no there. There's nothing here that you can overturn. And it was about that time, according to the committee information and the evidence being presented these days, that the president, the former president, and his allies began to turn to other things, other remedies to keep Mr. Trump in office, principally through the Congress, but through other mechanisms. And what they were doing is they're trying to exploit some of the ambiguities, if you will, as the committee was describing them this past week, in something called the Electoral Count Act, an 1887 law. Yes, it's still effective today. An 1887 law that kind of lays out the processes by which Congress finalizes a presidential election. And they argued in particular, this Eastman memorandum and this whole mechanism at the time, through Mr. Trump's allies and this sort of behind the scenes, now no longer legal process, a behind the scenes mechanism, that it was through the vice president, through Mike Pence, who presides over this ceremonial session to count the electoral votes. That was the ultimate avenue through which they would effectively overturn the will of the people, as those electoral votes would indicate, and would quite literally throw the electoral votes out and throw the decision to elect Joseph R. Biden Jr., our president, and if you will, keep Donald Trump in office. And so that was kind of the mechanism that we saw this past week. How do they go about doing that? And again, this morning, in the remaining time that we've had, I'd like to chat and again invite your calls at 844-967-2789 about the two big tranches, the two big movements I see in this area. One, of course, was coming from one of the very compelling testimonial presentations by a fellow named Greg Jacob, who was the principal lawyer for the vice president at the time. Mr. Jacob knew from the very early times that this plan that was being put together, by which basically the vice president would declare that the electoral votes right in front of him were not legitimate. It's obviously had all sorts of predicates even before then. Part of the plan was to have these false electors from a number of different states, including right here in Wisconsin. That was a part of it. An entire mechanism that would lead up to this decision by the vice president to basically throw the election out. And throw it back to the states so that there could be further efforts to keep Donald Trump in the presidency. And what did Mark Jacob say about what the vice president knew and what we thought about that time? Compelling stuff. He said basically that he knew that his boss, Jacob's boss, the vice president, he knew that that plan was unlawful from the start. Very significant information, again, about what the vice president knew Mr. Pence's first reaction upon hearing it, according to Mark Jacob, was that there was no way that this was justifiable. And significantly, Mike Pence, again, very much behind the scenes, apparently told his staff that this might be the most important thing I ever say when he came to describing his own reaction to this proposal by Eastman and by the president to keep him in office. We also had testimony that by January 4th, a couple of days before the insurrection, Mike Pence and Mr. Jacob, his counsel, were quite literally in the Oval Office when Mr. Trump and Mr. Eastman were also there. And according to Mr. Jacob, at that meeting, it was Eastman who admitted in front of the former president that his plan actually violated the Electoral Count Act. And that goes to the prior testimony also of this committee. We had all this testimony early on, the previous hearings and meetings, when you had people telling the president directly, his own attorney general, Bill Barr, his own daughter saying, Mr. President, there is no there. The election was not stolen. We know that not only from the many, many cases out there, but just no indication of election fraud. This is indeed the big lie, as has come to be called in America. And they're saying that to him on January 4th. Not only the vice president, but others as well. And we're going to talk right after the break about the implications of the Mark Jacob testimony and other things that happened related to Mike Pence on January 6th, as those are being revealed by the committee. Come back. Call us at 844-967-2789 as we talk about the January 6th committee, the big takeaways legally and politically and for our government right after the break. And we're back. This is Jim Santel with you this morning, also with Connor here in the studios of WAUK Radio in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Right before the break and during the course of this hour, we're talking about January 6th and the big takeaways from this past week, the committee revelations, principally through some testimony, some video, again, some very compelling information about what was going on behind the scenes right before January 6th, the attack on the riot. And then we can also talk about the day, January 6th itself, that also is incredibly revelatory about what our former president knew and thought about, and the role that our former vice president played in pushing back and refusing to go along with this Eastman plan, this proposal to overturn the election and send the decision-making authority back to the states. And right before the break, we were talking about this very, very interesting meeting that's happening on January 4th, a couple of days right before the insurrection itself. Greg Jacob, who is the principal counsel for the vice president, in the Oval Office with President Trump and John Eastman, having this conversation about what they're going to be doing. Along the way, according to Greg Jacob, Eastman says, I am here to request that you reject the electors. And again, we know because of what happened next that Eastman knew at the time that kind of request was unconstitutional. There's no basis for it. And indeed, as a part of our focus these days on the Supreme Court, very interesting to note that Mr. Jacob was very certain about having the law on his side, not on the Eastman side. And as he discussed these various legal arguments, all of which were just incredible, not founded, not predicated upon any rational basis, Mr. Eastman, who was the author of this overall design involving electors, involving things going on in the well of the Congress, Eastman himself admitted that his theories would fail 9-0 before the United States Supreme Court if they were ever tested in that particular venue. So we know all of those kinds of things going on. A lot of problems in terms of the internal discussions being had there. And why am I focusing on this? Because it does go to the president's knowledge, right? His intent. A lot of focus these days in the midst of the revelations by the committee about what the president knew and what he didn't know. We knew last week, we know again this week, that virtually everyone, perhaps including Mr. Eastman himself, the very designer, the author of this mechanism, this unfounded mechanism to overturn the electoral results, all of them knew that what they were doing was not only illegal, contrary to law, but had no viability in under any constitutional principle. And that resulted in the president's having to know that his own advocacy publicly at that time and certainly afterwards, indicating that this was in fact a big lie, that indeed the election had been stolen, and that the proposals that he was putting together privately to overtake the election results, the accurate election results, frankly, were inconsistent with what actually happened here. And so along the way, during the course of this past week, we also get this very chilling concern about the health and the welfare, the safety, the security of the vice president himself. There's a fellow named Mark Short, who's the chief of staff for the vice president. And a day before the mob violence, after this meeting in the Oval Office, Mr. Short gets very concerned about the president's actions. And he goes to the Secret Service and says that he is concerned about the president publicly turning against the vice president, potentially creating a security risk to Mr. Pence himself. This is his own vice president. And again, underscoring not only the volatility, the horror of what's going on inside our government at the time, right before January 6th, but also perhaps down the road, critically important, the knowledge that our former president had about his conduct. He knew in fact that what he was doing was not only illegal, unconstitutional, but completely contrary to the facts. That may become very, very significant if in fact the U.S. Department of Justice does in fact under Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, decide to pursue a criminal prosecution against any of these players, including arguably, the former president of the United States of America. Here's an interesting little insert that goes back to our discussion during the first hour about the role of religion in government and the extent to which the Free Exercise Clause has meaning. Mr. Jacob, who again is the principal attorney for the vice president, says during the course of this horrific event, where we were concerned about his boss's safety and security, pushing back, as is Mike Pence, against the president, these initiatives, these attempts to try to overthrow the results of the Electoral College. Mr. Jacobs says that his faith sustained him throughout the ordeal. And what does he say under oath? He says he pulled out his Bible in the secure location with Mr. Pence and read a passage in which Daniel is thrown into the lion's den after he refuses a king's order but is protected by God. And I would offer that's the kind of thing that indeed you can do. That is proper exercise of your religious liberties under the First Amendment. And it's the kind of thing we were chatted about during the course of our first hour. So many of these issues are much related. And that one, of course, happening on January 6th, which leads to the other portion of this, which goes to the very events of January 6th. And once again, where Mike Pence was, what he was doing. An incredible, once again, exchange between the president and the vice president. What do we know from the testimony of just this past Thursday? We know that at about 11:20 a.m. on January 6th, the president calls the vice president. The president is at the Oval Office, the White House, calls the vice president, who is at his residence at the Naval Observatory, up the street there in Washington, D.C., and the vice president steps away from his own staff that is dealing with things related to January 6th, and they have a conversation, that is the president and the vice president. And the group in the Oval Office could apparently hear this side of the phone call. During the course of the testimony from witnesses, including Mr. Jacob, during the course of the proceedings this past week, what we know about that is that the folks in the Oval Office hear the word wimp. A fellow named Nick Luna says, and he's an aide to the president, says in a videotape testimony that wimp is the word that I remember. This is the president calling the vice president a wimp, plainly for refusing, the vice president refusing to go along with his overall plan to overthrow the election. Mr. Pence, according to all the testimony, including the testimony of his own lawyer, says he is holding firm. Holding firm is in his refusal to give in. And this call becomes very, very difficult to ignore, both in the Oval Office and for people with the vice president himself. The chief of staff at that time, the president's chief of staff, Julie Radford, appeared in a videotaped testimony to say that the vice president's daughter's, Ivanka Trump's chief of staff, not the president's chief of staff, told her shortly after this call that Mr. Trump had this upsetting conversation with Mr. Pence. And the president, Ms. Radford, said, used the P word and said, you can either go down in history as a patriot or you can go down in history as something else. This is a very, very not just difficult phone conversation, but truly indicates the complete devolution, the complete breakdown of the relationship between the vice president and the president during that very period of time when all of us were observing things on January 6th. Mr. Pence, the vice president, comes back after this very difficult phone call with the president and tells his staff that he had just had this phone call. According to those folks in the room with the vice president, including Mr. Jacob, the vice president looks steely, nonetheless determined, grim to go ahead and not follow this plan. We know as well that in the hours that followed that phone call, the president goes out onto the Ellipse and tells the people publicly who are gathered there, tells the American population because it was televised. He says, I hope Mike is going to do the right thing. I hope so, because if Mike Pence does the right thing, we win. All of that language, which we remember very clearly from that Ellipse event, that happened after this very, very tumultuous conversation between the president and the vice president, plainly the ultimate breakdown in their relationship. And then we know as well, of course, that the vice president is at the Capitol at the time that the insurrection happens. He is beginning to count those electoral votes, and much of that now we've seen in the video as the attack is underway. The other significant thing that focuses on the vice president himself, and again, this the extent to which people knew what was going on and the importance of Mike Pence pushing back against this initiative. We're going to chat about that right after the next break in our final segment and some final observations about the takeaways from these big, big events being described by the January 6th committee just this past week. Also taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. Stay with us for the final segment here. We're talking about January 6th and the big lessons, the big takeaways, information otherwise from the committee findings. And we're back for our final segment this morning on Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. This is Jim Santel taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. In these last moments of our time together this morning, talking about January 6th and these incredible events, the relationship between the president and the vice president at that time completely breaking down, this phone call between the two of them in which there's name-calling going on by the former president at the former vice president, the vice president's complete refusal to go along with this proposal put together by John Eastman, others surrounding the president, his decision, his recognition, his advice from his own counsel, his own understanding that what was being proposed here was not legal, not constitutional, and saying, I simply will not do that. And we saw the vice president during the course of the day January 6th, following up on his own commitment, his own understanding, contrary to that of the president himself, that he did in fact need to go forward and do what really is a ministerial act in opening up these electoral votes, announcing them to the Congress. And we know again from the testimony provided by the vice president's counsel at the time and others during the course of the proceedings of this past week that during the course of Mr. Pence's presence on Capitol Hill, even as he and his wife were arriving there, that this mob was beginning to assemble outside of the Capitol, and that as the joint session began, very significantly, we heard testimony about Mr. Pence's, the circumstances of his releasing this memo to the public, laying out very clearly the vice president's view that he did not have the power to overturn the certification that Mr. Trump, the president, wanted him to do, and that his lawyer, John Eastman, insisted he do, even though, once again, they all knew that that was illegal. We know about the circumstances there. 2:10 in the afternoon, those proceedings interrupted by loud noises. The mob swarming into the building by 2:24. The Democrats and everyone else are bringing this to at least a suspension at that time. The vice president has moved off into another area for his security. The president tweets that Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what was necessary. And by that time, the Secret Service had moved Mr. Pence, the vice president, into the Senate chamber, and from the Senate chamber to his office across the hall. And there again, more conversation. Ultimately, he is led into a additionally secure environment. And we saw those pictures once again of the entourage making its way down a stairway toward that some underground loading dock, again at the Capitol. We've seen that a lot, but it was repeated by the investigating committee this past week. And Mr. Jacob, his counsel, testifies this past week to give us some more color behind all of that. He says, I could hear the din of the rioters in the building. I don't think I was aware that they were as close as that. In fact, they were very close. And as the testimony began to conclude, and as we began to conclude some of our commentary here, our summaries of some of the most important things from the committee, we have Mr. Jacobs telling us this past week this. He says the vice president did not want to take any chance that the world would see the vice president of the United States of America fleeing the United States Capitol. He's talking about the reason why Mike Pence pushed back on any efforts to take him out of the Capitol, to move him to a location beyond where he was going to continue counting votes. Mr. Jacobs said that Mr. Pence did not want to give the rioters the satisfaction of disrupting the proceedings more than they had already done. Here's the quote from Jacob himself. He, meaning the vice president, was determined that he would complete the work we had set out to do that day. During the course of that, those meetings that he was having, not one person he ever spoke to was convinced that Mr. Trump's theory was accurate, that it was right. And the vice president's view, again, was the one that carried the day. Nor, for significant reasons, did Mr. Trump ever check on the vice president's safety or security in the course of that day. Again, all of that coming out from the vice president's lawyer himself. The chief of staff, likewise, Mark Meadows, likewise not checking on the security or safety of the vice president. In the end, the vice president does say, today was a dark day in the history of the United States Capitol. He was greeted with applause when he said, let's get back to work. Let's get back to work. Back at the White House at the same time, again, according to this account, very reliably, compellingly told by the committee this past week, egged on by some of his advisors, the president told aides that he wanted some folks in his the vice president's staff barred from entering the West Wing from then on. And by 3:42 in that morning, it was all over. The new president's victory had been certified. At that time, at 3:50 in the morning, the president and his chief of staff and others went their separate ways. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. the vice president's staff member said at the end of that day. And again, what are the big takeaways from just those excerpts from the testimony of this past week? We know now with clarity. We know now with clarity the vice president understood not only his obligation to follow the law, and we know that it stood in complete opposition to what the president himself was in fact doing during the course of the day. And so we understand that all of that, again, a part of the presentation being made by the committee at the time. And as we begin to go into a break, we may have a caller, is that right? Online. We've got two callers. Let's take those callers in our last few moments here. Let's bring up our first caller who's got some comment and observations to offer to us this morning. We'll take the caller. Let them come on in and have some conversation with them. We'll talk with them right now. And we'll do that as soon as our caller comes up here. Again, we're talking about January 6th and the committee findings of the day. Very interested in having your observations in our last few moments of our time together this morning as we get them up and bring them on to our conversation here this morning. We'll pursue this again next Saturday as well, along with other conversation about the Supreme Court cases, likewise, that we have been talking about. While we're working on getting our callers connected in here, let me, again, to summarize our views and our perspectives of this past week, the very significance in terms of intent and purpose and going ahead as we think about the events of January 6th and the importance of those days. We know that the committee is going to continue to release the results of what it has been doing. We are also very much aware of the fact that the Congress itself does not have the capacity to prosecute anyone, including the people who we've chatted about, engaged in this effort to overturn the election. We understand completely that's only the U.S. Department of Justice. And that's why the other big news that's out there, has been out there for some period of time, is that the United States Department of Justice, under the Attorney General, is plainly looking at these same kinds of issues. We know from at least one person, Peter Navarro, who's been subpoenaed to appear before a grand jury, that investigation is going on. It is plainly parallel to what the House Committee is doing, probably looking at the same kinds of witnesses, the same kinds of people who are providing this testimony to the House Committee, much of which we've now seen revealed. And we know as well that the Department of Justice is looking at this predicate issue related to the electors. We know that Lisa Monaco, the deputy at Maine Justice, the deputy attorney general, has confirmed for us publicly that the U.S. Department of Justice is looking at the legality and the presence of those electors in state houses around the nation, again, right here in Wisconsin, the presenting of those false electoral documents to the authorities in Washington, D.C., again, as a part of this overall Eastman plan, the president's plan to overturn the election. We know that that is also being looked at by the U.S. Department of Justice. Plainly, the Department of Justice does not pursue its investigations in public, and so you're not going to see the grand jury proceedings. Those are necessarily, under Rule 6E, those are necessarily private proceedings. They are not a part of a public presentation. When we will see any of that would be during the course of any presentation of an indictment, an announcement of an indictment by the Attorney General with respect to anybody who might be the focus of this leadership group making decisions. We also may see some connections down the road between that leadership group and those people who have been indicted already, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, those folks who are actually organizing a lot of the especially volatile things on Capitol Hill. And if, in fact, those connections are made, whether it's by the House Committee or by the Department of Justice, that is additional, plainly very, very damning evidence about the connection between the organizers of this plot, this illegal, unconstitutional plot to overturn the election, and the people who are actually violently doing it, trying to stop and obstruct the course of proceedings on Capitol Hill. There is some promise from Liz Cheney, the vice chair, and from Benny Thompson, the chair, that there will be those connections in the coming days. We know that the committee is going to be meeting again on Tuesday the 21st and Thursday the 23rd. finally going to have an additional hearing or two beyond that as well to summarize this, probably also in prime time setting. And so we're looking to all of that. We'll take your calls down the road in future sessions here in the morning time, morning cannolis with Jim Santel here at WAUK 540 AM 101 FM. Join us again next Saturday for more discussion of these and other issues. Thank you so much for joining me this morning, and have a good week. Stay healthy, stay safe, and be well.